form.
BATF IRS CIAMDF BI FDA and FCC ADL and KGB. Now I know my ABCs, all of which spell tyranny.
All right, folks, Pastor Eli James here and Michael from Sweden. You are listening to Bloodline simulcasting on Speak Free Radio and Eurofolk Radio. Welcome, everybody. We have another show about the Balfour Declaration. We did part one last week along with the Genocide Convention, showing that the destroying a cultural group's heritage is genocide, according to the UN. But they don't enforce that on the behalf of the white race, because our culture is being totally genocided. And there's no doubt about it, and we know who's responsible for it, and that's why it never gets publicized. But anyway, we're going to continue with our study of the Balfour Declaration and the evil impact it has had on the world. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing very good here in Sweden. As you can also see, maybe on my feed, that it's a lighter outside. So here in the north, it starts to get lighter now. So that feels good. That this, now it gets, before it was just dark. So now it's lighter. So that feels very good. But despite the dystopic world we're living, because the world is dystopic, and I, as you and me spoke about before, is the lack of mentality among the white people. They have no mental capacity, so you have to do anymore. Funny cartoons for them to understand anything, I guess.
Right. Yeah, well, thanks for the lead-in, because I've been contacted by a couple of cartoonists, one located in London, one located in South Carolina, who have proposed to me that we do a series of comic books explaining Christian identity. So I wrote back to them and said, okay, well, you need to have a catchy name for the main character. You know, I suppose you could call him Yezu, right? But it shouldn't be too blatant. You know, I think art always works better when you're subtle rather than blatant. And then the reader, viewer can figure it out for himself or herself what the intent is. Okay? So the kingdom is doing fine. It's planet Earth is not doing so well. Okay? So welcome, everybody. Okay, so... yeah, I can't wait to start on this project of putting this information out in comic book form. And by the way, Brother Abair's calendar is ready. You can go to his website, thinkoutsidethebeast.com, and get the calendar there. And I just got a shipment of his calendars, but I haven't had a chance to open it up. I've been so busy. And then I'll put the information on how to get a calendar from me. And when I run out, then I believe Brother Abair will have it online also for free. So very important stuff, especially this year, because 2024 is the year of the triple eclipse, the one from 2017, the one coming up on April 8th. And we also had an annular eclipse in 2023. That intersected the other two eclipse lines, forming a letter Aleph. So I think these are prophetic signs from Yahweh that the judgment day is coming closer and closer. And it's also 2024. We're going to do shows about this, Michael. 2024 is the 70th Jubilee from the date that Joshua and the Israelites invaded Palestine and created Israel, through Israel. not that bandit state, that garbage state that calls itself Israel today. And so 70 is the number of judgment, folks. Okay. And also, it's a jubilee year, which means that all debts must be canceled. I believe this is a sign that Yahweh himself is going to declare a jubilee. And the way the jubilee year works, if you give me a second here to just interject this, Michael. The way the jubilee year works, and a lot of people get this wrong, especially Judeo-Christian theologians, the Jews don't pay any attention to this whatsoever because they don't believe in the Bible. They believe in their Talmud. So every year, every 49th year, on the Day of Atonement, which is part of the fall feast festivals, that begins the jubilee year. It's not a calendar year. It's a festival year. And so that year proceeds from the 49th year into the first year of the next cycle. Okay. So starting at Feast of Atonement in 2024 through Feast of Atonement in 2025, that is the Festival of Jubilee. Now, Yahweh's law says you must declare all debts canceled. Okay? That's his law. Unfortunately, the Israelites themselves rarely practice this, and certainly the Jews have never practiced it. Okay? So this will help expose the Jews and whatever plans the Jews have to collapse our economy are going to be trumped, excuse the expression, not by Donald Trump, but by Yahweh. So folks, get ready for very exciting times. The next few years are going to be really exciting. Over to you, Michael.
Yeah. And this with I think is very interesting, as you said, this with the first with this doing this project with this cartoonist to trying to right. giving the our message to giving it to maybe a broader group of people, because yeah. it's hard to reach yeah. them, to be honest. It's very hard to reach them, so I think that's a good, this could be a very good exactly. way to reach them. And because their right. their attention span is like TikTok or Facebook or Instagram, so I don't know how to really reach right. them.
Yeah. Well, so cartoon strips is the perfect way to go. Yeah.
Yes, it is. I think that's a very good idea. I hope they are genuine, so they don't make fun of us instead, or make something up if they are, so they are not liberal or something like that. So they just do this, you know, like a Jewish media sometimes does. They lurk you in and then they make fun of you, or they make some nasty articles yeah. about you and writing some nasty things about you.
Oh, yeah, and calling you all kinds of names, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think, yeah, we have to proclaim liberty throughout the land. That's what the year of Jubilee is all about, proclaiming liberty, which is something that has not happened in, well, we had the Liberty Bell, and that was proclaimed, it was rung every year, but somehow that Liberty Bell got cracked. I think that was an omen. Right. But maybe we need to cast another Liberty Bell without a crack. Okay. Yes. And so, folks, I think the Jewish stranglehold over the minds of our people is due for some serious shock. And I think this eclipse pattern that we're facing here on April 8th, along with the 70th Jubilee and other prophetic signs, which we'll be talking about in the near future, are all pointing toward the second coming. Okay.
Yeah,
they're all pointing towards the second coming. Okay,
and that also very interesting, as you said, is with the jubilee that you're speaking about. I think that is also a very important topic, so we can help some of our people to get it right.
Yeah, and it just shows, it demonstrates how poorly the Jews, the Talmudic Jews, follow Scripture. They don't follow it at all. And it's easy to prove, but as long as the Jews have this stranglehold on the minds of the Judeo-Christians and also white nationalists, because they believe the Jewish lies too, that once this stranglehold on our minds begins to fade, then the Jews are in big trouble, real big trouble. So the Jew bully. Thank you very much, Nibblehorse. The Jews are not going to bully us around like they have been because, number one, Michael, they are at war amongst themselves. Bibi Netanyahu with his absolutely brutal genocidal attack on the Palestinian people starting October 7th has generated really negative press for the Jews worldwide and has resulted in Jews being attacked physically and verbally in virtually every country where they exist. And so they overstepped. They've overstepped their propaganda bounds, Michael. I really do believe they have overstepped their bounds. And as they always do, because they're so proud and arrogant, they are going to shoot themselves in the foot and they're going to fall on their own sword.
Yes, amen to that.
Okay.
And that is also something that I'm thinking about, as you said, because now you can speak about the Jewish power. You can speak about how they murder they are, how they act toward the Palestinian. This has kind of opened the way to giving criticism to the Jews without having it being, oh, you're criticizing Jews. Oh, think about the Holocaust or whatever either stuff they come up with. And now you can start speaking about this stuff, that they are genociding the Palestinians. And does that make it okay for them to genociding the Palestinian, which they are doing? They're shooting one at a time and they are killing them off.
That's right. That's right. It's genocide. And the mainstream media, since it's owned by Jews, does not call it that. They're still pretending that the Jews are the victims of the October 7th. No, it was the Jews and they've been the perpetrators ever since the Balfour Declaration, which gives us, are there any Palestinians left? No, they're here in America. I can tell you there's a huge bunch of Palestinians in the southwest suburbs of Chicago. Unfortunately, they are Muslims. And they're hostile to America as well, right? A couple of friends and I tried reaching out to them because they still call America the great Satan. And we're trying to educate them. It's the Jews. It's not the Americans. It's the Jews that are the problem. But, Muslims are Muslims. I don't think there's any way we can work with the Muslims. A couple of people and myself have tried in the past. They just have their own agenda. They have their own way of thinking. And I don't think we can work with Muslims. Although there are other, identity people who have tried in the past to do that. I think it was Nord Davis, a very famous identity teacher, who tried to talk King Hussein of Jordan into an alliance between Christian identity and the country of Jordan, because his wife was an American, a white American woman. And he used her as an introduction to the King of Jordan, but he rejected the idea. Okay, so no, we cannot make any covenants with anybody but Yahweh. Okay, and the more we obey his laws, the more we will triumph, the quicker we will triumph. And that's got to be our message. Over to you, Michael, your first comment before we get back into the situation here.
But isn't that also what is said in the Mosaic laws, that we shouldn't make any covenant with other peoples?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So that's what's the problem people did before time. We did make covenant with them. We have, we should not do that. Same with all those big alliances we have now. We have NATO. We have the UN. We have all those big, where we are, that we are getting to be the minorities in those places. So I cannot, again, we are going into alliances that is not good for us. That will only be our demise. We should be separate, as also Yahweh has commanded us to be. We should be separate. Yes. Otherwise, we'll get mixed away.
Amen. 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 So, plus it's a part of the, a part of the strategy. And I think what's his name? Rockwell. No, not Lou Rockwell, who was the white nationalist that got murdered. He was trying to form an alliance between the Nation of Islam and the white nationalist group in America. Okay. And well, the Jews found out about it and he got murdered because he was going to come to Chicago where the Nation of Islam is centered. And both both groups were going to be talking about the Jews. Well, no, the Jews can't have that. They can't have an alliance between white nationalists and Islam, black Islamists. They can't afford to have that, right? Because their whole motivation is to divide and conquer. So once the Jews sniffs out something like that, it's over. Okay. Yeah, we need a separation of synagogue and state. That's exactly what we need. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so let's get back to this article, and it's about the Balfour Declaration. Let me introduce it, Michael, because we need to do a little bit of explanation of what we covered last time. And there was this guy by the name of Sharif Hussein, who was the leader of the Palestinian people, an Arab leader. And because he falsely believed that the Jews are the Israelites of the Bible, he deferred to the Balfour Declaration and made a commitment to it, which he later regretted. He regretted it greatly later. So let me just quote here about from the Disenchantment, and we put the link to this article in the chat room. And it's not paginated, but if you want to scroll or search for the word disenchantment, we're about maybe 1/6 of the way into the, or 1/5 of the way into the article. And I'll be reading from this paragraph. If the disenchantment of Sharif Hussein and his sons with Britain was gradual, the hostility of the Arab nationalists toward Britain on account of the Balfour Declaration was immediate and unremitting. Right. Why? Because the British, with the Balfour Declaration, declared that Palestine would now become a Jewish state. And of course, the British had no right to do that. And neither did the Jews. Right? Abd al-Hadi was a Palestinian politician who served as one of Amir Faisal's secretaries at the Paris Peace Conference. And Michael, we need to do a series of shows just about the Paris Peace Conference, one of the most incredibly evil conferences the world has ever known, totally run by Jews for Jewish purposes and to take control of planet Earth. That's what the Paris Peace Conference was all about. And during his short-lived administration in Damascus in 1920, he then served Amir Abdullah, Faisal's elder brother, in Transjordan. In 1924, he returned to Palestine and became one of the chief spokesmen of the Palestinian National Movement. Abd al-Hadi's impression was that Faisal resented the Zionist intrusion into Palestine, but was wary of upsetting the British. Faisal was also influenced, according to Abd al-Hadi, by the reassuring letters he received from his fathers in the early months of 1918 in his camp in Aqaba, on the subject of the Balfour Declaration. So the then leader of the Palestinian people was hoodwinked into accepting the Balfour Declaration. For his part, Abd al-Hadi did not believe in the possibility of cooperation with the Zionists in Palestine, and neither should anybody else. He was therefore very critical in his diary of Faisal for signing an agreement on Arab-Jewish cooperation with Dr. Chaim Weizmann, the head of the World Zionist Organization at the time, at their meeting in Aqaba on 4 June 1919. So, this is where the leaders of the Palestinian people went wrong. This is on 4 June 1919. This was like a year and a half after the Balfour Declaration was signed by Arthur Balfour and the Rothschilds. Okay? So the Rothschilds and the Zionists are all over this. But Michael, how much in the mainstream media or in the history books have you heard about this era, the Balfour Declaration, and how the Palestinian people were hoodwinked into allowing Jews to come into their country?
barely none. Not what I remember from the UFO school system. No, I read that by my own when I started reading, but then I was reading those, I'm using it loosely, controlled oppositions. They mentioned the Balfour Declaration, but they didn't just mention it right out to say Jewish, that it was the Jews that got to Palestine. So they mention it, but they are, for me, they were controlled oppositions. So I have to do some more digging before I really understand the implication of all this, what all this was all about, because you have to find out the pieces. So no, not in the school. I never heard about it, and I can assure you that no one in the Swedish school does know it today. So, and I guess that's it's the same in America too.
That's for sure. It's the same thing with the Federal Reserve Act here in America. It's mentioned in the economics textbooks, but no details are given, right? Okay, because you're not supposed to know the details, but that's what we're here for, folks, is to give you the dirty details and the dirty, filthy secrets that the Jews want to hide from you, okay? So let's continue. So, for June 1919, that's the critical date when Faisal signed the agreement on Arab-Jewish cooperation. Now, another question for you. Has there ever been true cooperation between the Jews and any other entity?
No, it's only one-way street with the Jews. It's only what they want, never what you can have not cooperate with them. If you see cooperation like with the Saudi Arabia, that's because they are crypto Jews, so they're also Jews.
That's right. That's right. So when it comes to dealing with the Jews, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. That's the reality, folks. They are not God's chosen people. They are the synagogue of Satan. Thank you very much, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. So, Abd al-Hadi notes that Faisal signed the agreement without understanding its implications because it was in English. Okay. Michael, would you sign a document that was, you understand English very well, but let's say it was written in, I was going to say Swedish. No, Arabic. Let's say it was written in Arabic. Would you sign a document before really understanding it?
No, that's the first rule or the first lesson, that you should never sign something you don't understand. I mean, it could be enough complicated on your own language. So if it's in a foreign language, come on. No, never.
Yeah. I have a feeling that Faisal might have been bribed.
Yeah, okay. Because I don't
no
think
no leader
people,
of any people.
Yeah, exactly. Would do that because he's not. They're not. I mean, they're not stupid at all. I mean, they're not that stupid. They know that.
Yeah, yeah. Biden may be stupid, but he's still a Jew operative, right? Has been for his entire career, and that's true of Trump as well. Let me repeat this, folks. Abd al-Hadi notes that Faisal signed the agreement without understanding its implications because it was in English, a language he did not know. Now, but very interestingly, a lot of people who are in the Western world who are forced into litigation don't understand that their lawyers, most of whom are members of the bar, work for the court. And will betray their clients for the court. And this happens all the time here in America. It certainly happens in Britain all the time and probably in Sweden as well. Because any lawyer who defies the Jewish controlled bar will find himself without clients in the future if he does not support the court against his own client. That's the reality. That's why there's no justice in America anymore. Okay. And if you hire a Jewish lawyer, you're doubly damned. Okay. Any lawyer in America who bucks the Anti-Defamation League and serves his client against the Anti-Defamation League will find himself out of a job very quickly. Okay. That's how much power the ADL here has here in America. And I'm sure Sweden has its version of the ADL. Does that come to mind, Michael?
Yes, we do. We do have something called Expo, and that is the same kind of organization. They only the same. They want to defend Jewish interest, and the one that is starting up or in control of it is someone called Robert Aschberg, and his grandfather is called Olof Aschberg, that had the Nya Banken that financed the Bolsheviks.
Oh, wow. Okay, there you go, folks. Bolshevism is Jewish, and most people don't know that. Okay, so let's continue. But he also notes that Faisal added a handwritten codicil, making the implementation of the agreement conditional on his demands concerning Arab independence being fulfilled. So, a handwritten note. Does anybody pay attention to handwritten notes by non-Jews?
No, never.
You thought that was going to have a legal effect?
No.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
but this handwritten note came from Rothschild, Eli. Come on.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah, it was dictated by a Rothschild lawyer. As these conditions were not fulfilled, the agreement became null and void. Okay, well, but whoever heard of this codicil? Whoever heard of these notes made by Faisal? This is the first I've ever heard of it. Okay? History has totally ignored Faisal's notes, his what we call it, complaints. His complaints against the Balfour Declaration. Now, it's bad enough that very few people have ever heard of the Balfour Declaration itself, right? So who's going to know about the notes that Faisal made against it? There are a number of other references. Yeah, no one. That's right. There are a number of other references to the Balfour Declaration in Ayuni Abd al-Hadi's diary, all of them highly critical of the British and of their Jewish protégés. Now, he's got this backwards. The British are the protégés of the Jews ever since the creation of the Bank of England. It's the tail wagging the dog, as we know. His basic view, repeated on several occasions, was that the declaration was made by an English foreigner who had no ownership of Palestine to a foreign Jew who had no right to it. Yeah, well, that's true. Neither the Jews nor the British had any right to speak on behalf of the Palestinian or act on behalf of the Palestinian people. Absolutely no doubt about that. Palestine thus faced a double danger. From the British mandate and from the Zionist movement. In December 1920, Abd al-Hadi participated in the Third Palestinian Congress in Haifa. The Congress denounced the actions of the British government and its plans for realizing the Zionist goals. It also rejected Balfour's promise of a national home for the Jews in Palestine as a violation of international law, of wartime allied commitments, and of the natural rights of the inhabitants of the country. In 1932, Abd al-Hadi founded the Palestinian branch of the Pan-Arab Independence Party, whose manifesto calls for the cancellation of the mandate and of the Balfour Declaration. Amen. They were asserting their rights. Arab hostility to the Balfour Declaration, as exemplified by Ayuni Abd al-Hadi, could have been predicted from the beginning. So why was it issued? Well, as I believe Faisal was bribed. Or the other tactic the Zionists use, well, if you don't sign this, your children will have broken legs or they will be assassinated. This is the type of power the Jews use in their quote unquote diplomacy. Okay. Do you want to pick it up from there, Michael?
For sure.
There's a typo right at the beginning.
I see.
It should be. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
The era are two main schools of thought on the origin of the Balfour Declaration. One represents by Leonard Stein, the other by Meir Werete, what later became the conventional wisdom on the subject was first laid out by Stein in 1961 in his masterly survey, the Balfour Declaration. This book provides a careful, detailed, and subtle account of the decision-making process that led Britain to issue the Declaration, but it does not reach any clear-cut conclusion. The conclusion implicit in the narrative, however, is that it was the activity and the skill of the Zionists, and in particular of Dr. Chaim Weizmann, that induced Britain to issue its famous statement of support for the Zionist cause. Stein's book was subjected to an extended critique by Meir Verete of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in a notable article he published in 1970 entitled "The Balfour Declaration and Its Makers." So is this two Jews arguing about the Balfour Declaration, or is I missing something?
No, that is. Two Jews arguing about something is a really old story. That means that no resolution will occur. Or if there is a resolution, it will favor the Jews.
Yeah, and this also shows the Jewish mantra of always being on both sides of an argument. They always start up, and then people believe there are something called good Jews, but it's not.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, well, they have to maintain the illusion that there is such a thing as a good Jew.
Okay. Yeah, that's
can't all be evil, can they?
Well, Christ said so they must be.
Yeah, he did. He did, because their DNA. They can't help but act out their DNA.
Yes.
Okay.
So, according to Verethe, the declaration was the work of hard-headed pragmatists, primarily motivated by British imperial interests in the Middle East. Far from the Zionists seeking British support, it was British officials who took the initiative in approaching the Zionists.
Okay, I don't believe that at all. The British government had no real interest in Palestine at all. A very, very small country. I don't think there's any oil there, although they recently have discovered oil. I mean, you're talking the whole Arabian Peninsula, that is a speck on the map. Okay? The British had no interest in that whatsoever. And they could have made alliances with the then already oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia, which they did, and Yemen and all those other countries. And they could have totally ignored Palestine, and it wouldn't have affected their interests whatsoever. Okay? Mm-hmm. It was only the Jews who had any interest in Palestine. Back to you.
Yeah. The definition of British interest in the Middle East began in 1915, leading to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which reconciled Britain's interest with those of France, with a compromise over Palestine. On further reflection, however, the British felt that control over Palestine was necessary in order to keep France and Russia from the approaches to Egypt and the Suez Canal. In Verete's account, it was the desire to exclude France from Palestine rather than sympathy for the Zionist cause that prompted Britain to sponsor a natural home for the Jewish people in Palestine. It was also through that the declaration favorable to the ideas of Zionism was likely to enlist the support of the Jews of America and Russia for the war effort against Germany. Finally, rumors that Germany was courting the Zionists accelerated the peace. A pace at which Britain moved toward its dramatic overture. In contrast to Stein, Verete concluded that Zionist lobbying played a negligible part in drawing Britain toward Palestine. A negligible part, the most considerable part, I would say.
Yeah, right. No, the reality is it wasn't the Germans that were courting the Zionists. It was the other way around. Because the history of Zionism vis-a-vis Germany in the Middle East was because, well, Germany was allied with the Muslim Empire. that actually at that time controlled Palestine. And the Jews were trying to get Germany to influence the Turks to give up Palestine. And the Kaiser told the Jews, I can't do that. That's controlled by Turkey, and Turkey's our ally. There's no way I can do that. Besides, it's not our decision, right? Nor is it the Jews' decision, right? So Germany was being quite honest about the situation, and also they approached the Sultan of Turkey. I said, "Dear Mr. Sultan," the Zionist said, "can you give us Palestine?" And he said, "No, it's not mine to give." So when they were rebuffed by both Germany and Turkey, that's when they decided on the Balfour Declaration, utilizing British military might, dragging American military might into the conflict. They already had Russia involved, and then Germany and Austria were stabbed in the back by the Jews because of the Balfour Declaration. Europe had no interest in Palestine. No European power had any interest in Palestine. It was only the Jews. Back to you.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, it was only Jewish interest to draw them here to this desert. It was blooming under, I guess, the Arab, but now the Jews have destroyed it, of course, because they don't farm.
Right.
A similar thought, right? Not identical argument, was advanced by John Kimsche in the Unromantics, the Great Power and the Balfour Declaration. As the title suggests, the author believes that the driving force behind the declaration was not sentimentality, but hard-headed realism. Kimsche, however, attributes this realism not only to the British, but to the Zionists as well. Indeed.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
He maintains that the interests of the two sides were identical, and that by working for a Jewish Palestine, they were working at the same time for the British Palestine. The declaration provided the stepping stones. Each partner used the same stones, but later went his own way. This, argued Kimsche, was the basic realism which Balfour and Weizmann approached their compact. They understood that they would have to go together part of the way, but that a time would come when they would have to part.
Okay, now if that's the understanding of Balfour, it means that Balfour understood there was no permanent interest for Britain in Palestine. Right?
Right. It's only Jewish interest. Yeah. So the British
That's
were.
Right. Who are the pawns in this game besides the Palestinians? That's right. The British were the pawns in this game. Please continue.
What is beyond question, as Kimsche himself points out, is that there was little room for such sophisticated in the heated politics of wartime Britain and post-war Zionism.
Right. Well, no. First of all, this article totally ignores the fact that one of the main reasons for the Balfour Declaration was to involve American Jews and to get Woodrow Wilson to enter the war, get America to enter the war by putting pressure on Woodrow Wilson. Okay? That was one of the main reasons for the Balfour Declaration, to drag America into the war. Back to you.
Yeah, that's a major part, because that was one of the keys to if they got America into the war.
Yeah, and actually the Germans, once they realized the Americans had been dragged into the war, they called it the stab in the back, because America, we were neutral. America was a neutral country at the beginning of World War One, and it was Woodrow Wilson who betrayed Germany because he accepted the Balfour Declaration's terms and he campaigned on the slogan that I kept our boys out of the war. That was his campaign slogan. But as soon as he was reelected, he petitioned Congress to declare war.
Yeah.
This is the type of treachery that you get from American presidents who are puppets of the Jews. Back to you.
Yeah, because they are lovers of filthy money.
Right, filthy lucre. You got it. Okay.
Yeah, same in Sweden also. It's same everywhere with politicians, because politicians have always double loyalty, and they have no loyalty to the people.
No, none whatsoever. It's, their loyalty is only to their paymasters, which in virtually every country on the face of the earth today are Zionists. Okay.
Yeah. The historiography of the Balfour Declaration took a step forward in 2000 with the publication of Tom Segev's book on the British Mandate in Palestine. Segev's contribution lies in the interpretation he develops of the origin of the British rule in Palestine. His revisionist account is based on new source materials as well as a new synthesis of earlier studies on the subject. In Segev's version, the prime movers behind the Balfour Declaration were neither the Zionist leader nor the British imperial planner, but Prime Minister David Lloyd George. In his memorials, written some 20 years after the event, Lloyd George explained his support for the Zionist movement during the First World War as an alliance with hugely influential political influential political organization whose goodwill was worth paying for.
Goodwill from Zionists? Really? No. No way this is accurate. He was another puppet of the Jews. Back to you.
The common wisdom in Britain at the time Lloyd George published his account was that the country had erred in supporting the Zionists and that he was probably trying to justify his wartime policy.
Okay, pardon me. Mea culpa. I did wrong. And he's trying to explain it away. Back to you.
Segev will have none of it. Lloyd George's support for Zionism, he argues, was based not on British interest, but on ignorance and prejudice. In his own way, Lloyd George despised the Jews, but I don't know, I don't buy that.
Yeah.
Really, but
well, maybe he did, but finish the sentence.
But he also feared them. And he
proceeded
on the basis of an absurdly inflated notion of the Zionist power and influence.
No, that's not possible. Lloyd George understood the power of the Rothschilds and the Bank of England. There's no way he couldn't understand that. Okay? Because the Rothschilds had control, well, the Jews had controlled the Bank of England since 1694. And they're the ones responsible for British imperialism and the Opium Wars and all other wars that involved Britain. The Jews, that's the kind of power the Jews had in Britain. Is there any doubt about that, Michael?
No, it is no doubt, because this David Lloyd George, when he was elected or selected as prime minister, he did go probably to the Bank of England and pledge that he wanted to rule Britain for their sake. So he knows
where
the power is.
Just like Biden and Trump.
Exactly. Okay. And McCain and everybody else before that did go to the Rothschild and ask for their power, for their support.
Yeah, and so did Hillary and Barack Obama and the Bushes and Reagan too. The only one that didn't, well, actually before Kennedy, I mean after Kennedy was, who was the president? The football player from Michigan. Well, we had Carter, and then we had the predecessor to Reagan. I can't remember. I'm sorry, folks. I should know all the president's names, but I forgot this guy. Anyway. There was there was a Republican who was a football player from Michigan we had as president, but he was also in the employ of the World Zionists. No doubt about it. Okay, back to you.
And that is something part that is missed in this article, because now it sounds like this mystery above all this, this is a big mystery with the, yeah, you get details of it, but you don't get this the amount of how the Jews is ruling those people behind the scene, like Lloyd George. Why does he fear them? Yeah, because he has pledged with them. He has said he is allegiance with them.
Because if he doesn't ally with them, he will be assassinated.
Yeah, or they find some honey trap and send on him, and then he will be in some bad news.
They always, as we know here in Christian Identity, they always use prostitutes. The Jewish bankers always use prostitutes to compromise. Maybe Hillary Clinton, right? Political leaders, because she's a known lesbian, right? All right, back to you.
In alleging Britain with the Zionists, he acted in the mistaken and anti-Semitic view that the Jews turned the wheels of history. In fact, as Segev shows, the Jews were helpless, with nothing to offer. Having knew him...
that's a... That's a blatant lie.
They had everything to offer.
Segev is a Jew, obviously. Right.
Yeah, must be. Okay. Name sounds very...
he's a Russian Jew. That's what he is,
Having no influence other than the generated by the myth of clandestine power.
No, bankers have no power whatsoever. Okay.
As for the Zionists, being a minority within a minority, they could not even speak in the name of world Jewry.
But they did. That's an absolute lie. Okay. So this author is simply showing us his bias at this point in time. Okay, well, we're at the top of the hour. So, folks, let's take a break. And I'm going to play... my song called These Terrible... Well, it's not. It's based on a song by another band. I'm just using their melody to put lyrics to. These chairs were made for burning. We're going to take a break, folks. We'll see you in a few minutes. And here we go. It takes a minute to load up.
You keep saying you're God's chosen people.
Hey, we'll be back in about 5 minutes, folks.
Someone's coming to put you in your place. You've been messing with the people's money, yeah. You rob us with a smile on your face. These lips are made for talking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days the Lord is gonna walk all over you. You've been getting by on all your chutzpah. Assassinations, bribes, wars and more. The Goy are busy waking from their slumber, yeah. Babylon will surely be no more. These lips are made for shouting, and that's just what they'll do. From the rooftops we will see your judgment coming true. You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing, and you keep thinking that you'll never get burned. Ha! The day will come when you have met the rider, yeah, of the white horse with his flaming sword. These tears are made for burning, that's what he's coming for. One of these days, he said, your kind will surely be no more. ready, Taz? Start burning. Are you ready, Word? Start hurting. No more tricks buff for you. No more laughing by you. It's all over for you. It's all over for you.
All right, I'm back. I'm waiting for Michael to come back, and that audio was really bad on my end. I hope it was clearer for you. So we've been having audio difficulties, but I think fortunately the regular part of the show has been working just fine. This gives me an opportunity to talk about Money Tree Publishing, the sponsor of Speak Free Radio, and the cooperation between your folk radio and Speak Free Radio. All of this set up by Paul English in London. And thank you, Paul. Thank you, David Gaheri, for all of the work you've put into this. And some of the books offered are like Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. And we're going to be talking, we're going to be doing Adolf Hitler's view of the Balfour Declaration in upcoming episodes. Of course, my book, The Great Impersonation, Exposing the Lies of History, The Secret Masonic Victory of World War II, not to mention World War I, Communism by the Back Door, The Greatest Story Never Told, Hellstorm, this is a wealth, an exploding Middle East myth, and the host and the parasite. So In the Name of Yahweh, and other books available at Money Tree Publishing. All of this, which is banned literature by the Jews, fortunately. We are making an impact on Jewish power in America. We have freedom of speech, although the Jews are trying to eliminate the First Amendment and the Second Amendment as we speak. The Supreme Court has upheld both. However, the Jews are constantly chipping away at the First and Second Amendment, and we'll see. But they're not going to overthrow those amendments. They're just going to try to minimize their impact on our culture by chipping away at freedom of speech and the freedom to bear arms. So we have to fight against this. It is imperative that we fight against it, and we will. And that's what we're doing here at Eurofolk Radio, and Speak Free Radio supports our efforts, and likewise we support their efforts to awaken the world to Jewish perfidy, Jewish criminality, and a Jewish banking establishment that controls the world. So let's get back to this. And here, let me just quickly see. Okay, yeah, welcome back, Michael. So, let me pick it up where we left off on the Balfour Declaration. Actually, why don't you finish where you were, because I forgot where you were. Okay. So,
I do that. Okay. So, okay. Lloyd-George misconceptions about the Jews were widely shared amongst the ruling class in Britain. As was his...
No, he was right about the Jews. So was Hitler. But they had no power against the Zionists because they knew. Well, just take a look at Russian history. All of the political figures of Russia assassinated by Jews for the previous 100 years. And they knew that the Jews assassinated Abraham Lincoln. They knew about that. And even in America in the 1920s, Congressman Louis T. McFadden issued many public statements against the Jew-controlled Federal Reserve Bank, in which he documented that the Federal Reserve Bank financed communism during this period. And he was assassinated. So the history of assassinations clearly points to the fact that any politician who wants to defy the Jews is risking his own life. Back to you.
Yeah. And I've read about him in this very it's a short book, but it's a history about central bankers. And that's where he is mentioned. And this big struggle that you had against the central banker for a long time before you were sold out on, what was it, Christmas Day or something like that, when you were sold out.
And that was also under Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, because of his affair.
Yeah, right, with Mary Peck.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So blackmail. They used blackmail to control Wilson.
Yeah, exactly. And also, didn't they also get in a Jewish lawyer into your high court, in your Supreme Court by that?
That's right. That's right. That's how the Jews get their foot in the door, through blackmail. Yeah.
Okay, so let's continue. As was his antipathy toward the French. In Segev's summary, the British entered Palestine to defeat the Turks. They stayed there to keep it from the French, and they gave it to the Zionists because they loved the Jews, even as they looted them. At once, admiring and despising them, the British were not guided by strategic considerations, and there was no ordered decision-making process. The Balfour Declaration was the product of neither military nor diplomatic interest, but of prudence, faith, and sleight of hand. The men who served it were Christian and Zionist, and in many cases anti-Semitic. They believed the Jews controlled the world. Well, they do, and did, so I don't know. control the world.
Yeah, he's right about that. He's right about that. Right? Yeah.
Britain's belief in the mystical power of the Jews. Yeah, the mystical power is called banking and money.
That's right. Fractional reserve banking. Amen. Yeah.
And that's their magic. That's the mystery Babylon. How they rule behind the scenes. That is the mystery that we are trying to tell all of your listeners about. The mystery. Yeah. That is not a mystery.
No, it's not a mystery to anybody who understands true economics. Yeah.
Overrode reality. And it was on the basis of such spurious consideration that Britain took the momentous decision to sponsor the Zionist cause.
Yeah. So do you think in the wildest dreams of the British people that mythology motivated this political decision?
What would you say?
Mythology. He said, or mysticism.
No, right? No, I didn't think that. Yeah. No, that did not motivate this.
Yeah.
Money motivated it.
It was, the reality is that the Jews had this kind of power. It's not a myth. It's not mysticism. Back to you.
No, exactly. It is their power. They have immense power.
Amen.
And that's why we're talking about it, because then their power will diminish if we let them know how their power is. Because that is how their luxury that Rothschild has been having for all those years is that nobody's speaking about them. But now we are speaking about them and their power structure.
Yeah.
And that then their power will diminish.
Yeah, fade. Yeah. And as we see, they're also fighting amongst themselves, because here Chuckie Schumer, one of the most powerful Zionists in America, has begun criticizing Bibi Netanyahu for his blatant genocidal policies, right? Because the Jews are getting a black eye worldwide because of that. Okay? So let Bibi continue and let the Jews get two black eyes and see what they do. Back to you.
Yeah. On one point, there is a broad consensus among admirers as well as critiques of the Balfour Declaration that it was a considered statement of policy issued after prolonged deliberations, painstaking drafting and redrafting, and careful wording before the British government gave the declaration to the world. It closely examined every word and incorporated in the text countless charges and corrections. All this effort did not, however, result in a clear or coherent text. On the contrary, they compounded its opaqueness.
Opaqueness. Opaque is you can't see through it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Ambiguity, and worst of all, internal contradictions. The greatest contradiction lay in its supporting, however, vaguely, the right to national self-determination of a minority of the inhabitants of Palestine, while implicitly denying that right to the majority. At the time, the proposed statement was under discussion in the war cabinet. The population of Palestine was in the neighborhood of 670,000 of these. The Jews numbered some 60,000. The Arabs thus constituted roughly 91% of the population, while the Jews accounted for 9%. The proviso that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine implied that, in British eyes, the Arab majority had no political rights. Yeah,
well,
we see that.
No, it's,
continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, but you see that today. See that today. How much has this been worth? Those words, because the Arab has been nothing, not a word, because they've been murdered, and now they're getting exterminated. So not worth a dime. So you can never ever trust a Jew, never ever in any way.
Yeah, I think that these words, "nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine," I believe it's the British. And under Balfour, who inserted these words, okay, and hoping that the Jews would comply, right? But they never have, and they never will, because the Jews have their dogmatic, imperialistic agenda, and anybody who stands in the way will just be, you know, wiped away, right? The Balfour Declaration was a promise extracted from Britain by the Jews to give legitimacy to their invasion of Palestine. That's all it is. Okay. A veneer of legitimacy. It's totally an illegitimate document. And only the Jews had any interest in Palestine. There's a Sykes-Picot agreement. The British and the French could have worked out their differences. And, you know, who wants that stinking little country? There was no oil there or known at the time, right? You know, why it had, I don't think it even had any exports. So there was nothing there in Palestine to, for a colonial empire to exploit. Okay. Nothing. All right. Please continue.
But it was something for an impersonational group called Jews to try to impersonate to Israel. That's
right. Yeah. And of course, that was the Zionist plan all along. And the author is ignoring that.
Okay. Yeah, and that's an important piece of the puzzle, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most important piece because we know that this was all planned by the Zionists, you know, 50 to 75 years before. Okay, and in their own documents, like Moses Hess, in his book, Rome and Jerusalem, how the Jews intended on taking over Jerusalem. And in the Theodor Herzl, he wrote a book about how the Zionists intended to take over Palestine. You know, Chaim Weizmann and the Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1896 declared their intentions as well. So, you know, the author is totally ignoring known history. All right. All right, let me pick it up from there. Part of the explanation for this peculiar phraseology is that the majority of the ministers did not recognize the Palestinians as a people with legitimate national aspirations, but viewed them as a backward, oriental, inert mass. No, that's how the Jews viewed them.
Yeah.
Okay?
That was a Jewish look about every other people than themselves.
That's right. That's right. And like I said, there was really no colonial aspiration of either the French or the British for Palestine, that those two nations wanted to control the oil and mineral resources of the Arabian Peninsula. That's what they wanted. And the Paris Peace Conference granted them all of this kind of power and utterly destroyed Germany. Okay. So again, this is this document, although it does incorporate some true fact. Here, the author is showing his bias, his pro-Jewish bias. And, you know, I mean, are the British so stupid that they would, risk their national integrity and their own power by through mythology and mysticism? No. No, it's banking power. That's, you know, that's what's really going on. So anyway, let me continue here. Arthur Balfour was typical of the so-called Gentile Zionist in this respect. Quote, "Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad," he wrote in 1922, "is a far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land." That's an absolutely true statement.
Yeah, if from the Jewish point of view, it is.
Yeah, and even from Arthur Balfour, he's basically saying that Zionism is more powerful than Britain.
Yeah.
Let me repeat this statement. Zionism. Now, also Winston Churchill, he issued a statement about Zionism and communism around this time as well. I think it was in 1920 in the Illustrated Sunday Herald, a publication of London, where he said communism is Jewish. Right? He just came out and said it. Communism is Jewish, but he was a pro-Zionist also. Okay. So why would all these crypto-Jewish maybe, why would all these British politicians be supporting Jewish movements? Neither America nor Britain or any other country in the world has any interest in Jewish movements. But it's the tail wagging the dog under the threat of assassination and political career-ending events that will be staged against you that motivate people like Arthur Balfour. Let me repeat this statement because it is absolutely 100% true. Quote, "Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is a far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land." He's saying it's Zionism that is the real power. Let's continue. "The most charitable explanation," now back to the author, "the most charitable explanation that may be offered for this curious claim," it's not a curious claim, it's the absolute truth, "is that in an age of colonialism, everyone was in some sense," what about Zionist colonialism?
Yeah, they never speak
everyone
about that.
Everyone was in some, never talk about that. They never speak of Zionism as a form of colonialism, which it absolutely 100% is. Yeah, everyone, it was in some, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, but everybody in the West know that, but not know it, but we are under their colonialism in their banking system. So we are exactly under their colonial rule.
Yeah. It's bankers' colonialism. And we did that series a few weeks back showing how the banking colonialism controls all of Africa.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
But you know, the media never talks about banking colonialism.
Never.
Okay. So, and I don't know if this author is Jewish, but he's certainly taking the approach that, this is anti-Semitic, and to blame the Jews for what happened in Palestine is mythology. No, it isn't. Okay. But this is the tack. Yeah, so the Jews hire authors like this to explain away, you know, the fact that they are the aggressors, they are the colonialists, they are the occupiers, and they are the genociders. Plain and simple. Okay, so let's continue. "Balfour may appear today like an extreme example of the colonial mentality, but he was not untypical of his era." Well, he basically being honest here, that Balfour is simply saying, neither I nor my cabinet nor anybody else in Britain was capable of going against Zionist intentions. That's for reasons obvious. Because the Zionists had controlled Britain since 1694, even before the word Zionism was invented. And they were the ones who invented British colonialism for Jewish profit. You know, any power that has that much influence in a country must be reckoned with, must be revealed, must be exposed. And this author here is trying to cover it up. Let me continue here. Yet Balfour's specific proposal to come out in favor of the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine did not enjoy unanimous support round the cabinet table. Of course not. The Jews always get their way in spite of the fact that they never get unanimous support from the country they're controlling. But, now, this is interesting, though, because it's true that there were many Jews who were opposed to Zionism and control of Palestine by Jews. Edwin Montagu, who sounds like a Jew to me, oh, yeah, he is. Okay, so he was stated as being Jewish in the article here. The Secretary of State for India and the only Jewish member of the government considered Zionism a threat to the Jews of Britain and other countries. Yeah, because he was afraid of a backlash. He denounced Zionism as a, quote, mischievous political creed untenable by any patriotic citizen of the United Kingdom, unquote. So is Montagu basing his opinion on mythology and mysticism, Michael?
No, I think he's basing it upon the knowledge about these people.
That's right. That's right. But the Zionists were all powerful in terms of being the money power. Montagu rejected the idea of the Jews as a nation and argued that the demand for recognition as a separate nation put at risk their struggle to become citizens with equal rights in the countries in which they live. So in other words, Montagu is saying, well, we Jews have become all powerful by being secret operators in the background of every nation. Why should we change? Why should we change that? And he was definitely afraid of backlash. You know, why change a system that is working so well on behalf of world Jewry? Lord Curzon, a member of the war cabinet, was more troubled by the implications of the proposed move for the rights of the Arabs of Palestine. Quote, how was it proposed, he asked his cabinet colleagues, to get rid of the existing majority of Muslim inhabitants, that is Arabs and Islamists, to introduce the Jews in their place? That's a fair question. In a paper to the cabinet, he returned to the theme, quote, what is to become of the people of the country? The Arabs and their forefathers have occupied the country for the best part of 1,500 years, and they own the soil. They profess the Mohammedan faith. They will not be content either to be expropriated for Jewish immigrants or to act merely as hewers of wood and drawers of water for the latter. Okay? That is an extremely fair statement. Extremely. Now, what's the Jewish position on Palestinians today? Oh, there were no Palestinians. That is what the Jews teach about the Palestinians today. The Jews always change their argument. Okay? This is 100% treachery through and through. Let me continue here. Montagu and Curzon were overruled. The three most powerful men in the cabinet, Lloyd George, Balfour, and Lord Milner. Oh, Milner, he was a Rothschild agent. He profited from Rothschild enterprises in South Africa, gold, diamonds, silver, etc., threw their weight behind the proposal. At the crucial meeting on 31 October 1917, the cabinet approved the final wording of the Declaration of Sympathy for a National Home for the Jews in Palestine. Curzon restated his misgivings and his pessimism about the future of Palestine. Do you think Curzon was right, Michael?
Yeah, it sounds yeah. so.
Yeah, he was the only reasonable voice, and the other guy, even the Jew, was more reasonable. The Jewish member of the cabinet was more reasonable than the Zionists. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Largely in deference to his anxieties, the final version of the declaration contained a caveat about protecting the civil and religious rights of the non-Jewish communities in Palestine. My speculation was correct that it's a bone thrown to the Palestinian people, which the Jews would never honor. Okay. Chaim Weizmann was waiting outside the room where the war cabinet met. Okay, yeah, you better make the right decision, you goy. You better make the right decision. Well, because they could destroy Britain anytime they chose by collapsing the economy. And the cabinet knew that. In the early afternoon, Sir Mark Sykes emerged calling Dr. Weizmann, "It's a boy!" Right? It's a Jew. It's a Jew, folks. Okay. Michael, I'll turn it over to you. I'm really disillusioned with this article because of its all of a sudden pro-Zionist stance and et cetera, and pro-Jewish stance. But it just gives you a flavor of what type of literature is available about the Balfour Declaration. Virtually all of it is pro-Jewish. It's really hard to find an article that gives the true facts without apology. All right? Okay, Michael, over to you. While Chaim Weizmann is the next paragraph.
Yes. While Chaim Weizmann's part in procuring the Balfour Declarations may have been exaggerated, his role in keeping Britain to its rash wartime promises was of critical importance. Weizmann went as the head of the Zionist delegation to the peace conference that converged at Versailles in January 1919. His aim was to ensure that the British would remain in Palestine.
Because they needed an excuse to get in, and the British mandate was that excuse. It is totally unauthorized and illegitimate conference called the Versailles Peace Conference. Back to you.
At the conference, he pleaded for the international ratifications of the Balfour Declaration, but at the San Remo Conference in April 1920, the French representatives objected to the inclusion of the language of the declaration in the text of the mandate over Palestine. And then I guess Eli here in this other conference, it must be Jews there as well. So here we see Jews arguing about amongst themselves.
Yeah, I think because this is, you know, why would the French object? And the author doesn't go into why the French objected. Okay, so who knows why? You know, he's not interested in explaining why the French would object. But I think really maybe the French wanted part of the mandate. You know, why would you want all that trouble? Why would you want the abomination of desolation to enter your political domain?
No,
why would you want? No. Now, it's possible the French simply objected to the whole thing. You know, that the idea that the Jews should displace the Palestinian people in spite of the proviso of Mr. Curzon. Okay. In spite of that proviso. You know, because, you know, let's face it, all of the European delegates to the Paris Peace Conference, all of them knew the power of the Jewish banksters. All of them. Okay. So, and they, for fear of the Jews, because they didn't want to be assassinated or blackmailed or anything like that, they went along with the Jewish program. And it's called the Paris Peace Conference, or Versailles Peace Conference in this case. All right, back to you.
It took strong British pressure to persuade the League of Nations to incorporate the commitment to establish a Jewish national home in the terms of Britain's mandate to govern Palestine. Even before the international ratification of the Balfour Declaration, violent protests broke out in Palestine against Britain's pro-Zionist policy and against Zionist activities. The Arabs emphatically refused to recognize the declaration or anything done in its name, seeing it as the thin end of the wedge of an Anglo-Jewish plot to take over their country. Yeah, no, that's true. That was what was.
Yeah.
Well, again, you know, it's referred to as an Anglo-Jewish plot, but when you consider the fact that the Jews are using extortion, assassination, blackmail, and other forms of intimidation against British politicians to get their way, there's no way it's an Anglo-Jewish plot. It is a Jewish plot, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arab resentment toward the British and their proteges culminated in the Nebi Musa riots of April 1920. A court of inquiry appointed to investigate the riots noted that the Balfour Declaration is undoubtedly the starting point of the whole trouble. The court also reached the conclusion that Arab fears were not unfounded. The Nebi Musa riots were the first intrusion of mass violence into the Arab-Jewish conflict. The riots did nothing to advance the political aims of the Arab nationalists, but they also boded ill for the Zionists. Expectation of achieving their ends peacefully. In the words of Bernard Wasserstein, the riots and their aftermath created a gangrene of suspicion and mistrust in the British-Zionist relationship in Palestine, which was to subsist throughout the three decades of British rule. Throughout these three decades, Britain was subjected to repeated criticism from Zionist quarters for reneging or at least backsliding on its wartime pledges to the Jews. In self-defense, the British pointed out that the Balfour Declaration committed them to support a national home for the Jews in Palestine, not a Jewish state, not a British officials. However, adhered to this interpretation, Balfour and Lloyd George, for example, admitted in 1922 at a meeting with Winston Churchill and Chaim Weizmann that the Balfour Declaration had always meant a Jewish state.
There you go.
Yeah, so again, this proof, if you make a deal with the Jews, be prepared to be stabbed in the back.
Oh, yeah. The troubled and tangled history of the British mandate in Palestine has been told many times before, recently by Joshua Sherman and Naomi Shepherd, among others. And them both, I guess, is Jewish. I'm guessing on the names.
It sounds Jewish to me. Yep, I agree. Yep, okay.
Most historians of this period attribute to British policy a pro-Arab bias. Some Zionist writers go further. They accuse Britain not only of persistent partiality towards Arabs, but of going back on its original promise to the Jews.
Okay, so the British are the bad guys. All right, that's the Jewish opinion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom Segev makes a major contribution to the existing literature on this issue by putting Britain's record as a mandatory power under an uncompromising lens. His verdict is that British actions considerably favored the Zionist position and thus helped to ensure the establishment of a Jewish state. The evidence...
Absolutely.
Yeah, the evidence he presents to British support for the Zionist position is both rich and compelling. So, is the evidence he adduces for the proposition that once the Zionist movement came to Palestine with the intention of creating a Jewish state with a Jewish majority, war was inevitable. Yeah, we see that today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's been nothing but war ever since.
Yeah. It was peace in Palestine before the Jewish nation was formed. And you're not a nation, it's just a bastard nation.
Yeah, right.
The Jewish colonial enterprise, right. Occupation.
Yeah. From the start, there were only two possibilities, that the Zionists would defeat the Arabs or that the Arabs would defeat the Zionists. British actions tended to weaken the Arabs and to strengthen the Zionists as
right.
the two national movements moved inexorably toward the final showdown. The Arab nationalists in Palestine, under the leadership of the Grand Mufti High Amin al-Husseini, despaired of Britain and eventually threw in their lot with Nazi Germany. The Zionists, under the leadership of Chaim Weizmann, hitched a lift with the British Empire, advancing under its sponsorship to the verge of independence. The Zionists were not slow to grasp the importance for a weak national liberation movement of securing the sponsorship and support for a great power. Indeed, ensuring the support of the paramount Western power of the day remains to this day a basic tenet of Zionist foreign policy.
Well, essentially, we can say that the Palestinians were militarily impotent. You're talking about a bunch of Arabs on horseback with rifles, right? Compared to an enormous military power such as Great Britain backing the Zionists. And fortunately, the British never actually used their military power against the Palestinians. It was Jewish terrorists who were backed by Britain who did that. Back to you.
Yes. From the start, the central problem facing British officials in Palestine was that of reconciling an angry and hostile Arab majority to the implementation of the pro-Zionist policy that was publicly proclaimed on 2 November 1917. In general, British officials in Palestine had much more sympathy for the Arabs than did the policy makers in London. Many of these officials had an uneasy conscience, even a feeling of guilt.
Amen.
As a result of their political master's decisions to honor Britain's wartime promise to the Jews while breaking its promises to the Arabs. Some suggested a revision of the policy because, in their opinion, it involved an injustice to the Arabs.
Yes.
Yeah, but they constantly ran up against the argument that the declaration constituted a binding commitment. Even Lord Curzon, who had originally opposed the Balfour Declaration, concluded in 1923 that the commitment to the Zionists could not be ignored without substantial sacrifices of consistency and self-respect, if not of honor.
Okay, so he changed his mind, which is what you would expect a Jew to do, right? Initially, he opposed it. Now he gives us his blessing.
Yeah.
Okay. In the interim between 1920 and 1923, I'm sure the Zionists were visiting his house very often, demanding that he change his perspective. Okay. Right. Okay, so let me pick it up here. Oh, by the way, in the chat room, a very interesting Nimble Horse put a link in showing that the word Khazar comes from the Hebrew Khazir, which means swine. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting, folks? All right, let's go. Because we know that the Jews are the swine of the universe.
And,
you know, and they act as, and they act accordingly throughout history. Okay, so Arab resentment and riots in Palestine persuaded the Lloyd George government to replace the military government with a civil administration, but not to reverse its pro-Zionist policy. Okay, so the British didn't want any part of making war against Palestinians, which shows that the previous statements by the author that British reluctance to get involved is based on mythology of, you know, anti-Semitism, right? Yeah, that statement is absolutely 100% true. It's Zionist pressure on the British cabinet that got Britain involved in this whole mess, and it was 3 out of 5. So it was not a unanimous decision by the British cabinet. So let's continue. And once the government resolved to continue to support a Jewish homeland in Palestine, it could not have chosen a more suitable man for the post of High Commissioner than Sir Herbert Samuel. you couldn't have a better Jew than Sir Herbert Samuel, right, Michael? Okay.
Go ahead. Go on, Eli.
Yeah, it proves that the Jews are all over this. The Jews of Britain and international Jews as well. American Jews were involved in this as well, but they're not being talked about in this article. Okay. Samuel's association with Zionism was intimate, and his attachment to the Zionist cause was perhaps the one passionate commitment of his entire political career. Yeah. We want to pretend to be Israel to confuse the Judeo-Christians of the world into supporting the Zionist state. Samuel was sent to Palestine not because of or even despite his Jewishness, but because he was a Zionist. The appointment pleased the Zionists, but it destroyed the last vestiges of Arab faith in Britain's integrity and impartiality. There you go. You know, any puppet of the Jews will not get respect. Okay? That's just the reality, folks. Before Samuel took over from, now this is why America has no respect in the world anymore. Before Samuel took over from the military government, the chief administrative officer asked him to sign what became one of the most quoted documents in Zionist history. Quote, received from Major General Sir Lewis Bowles, B-O-L-S, KCB, whatever that means, one Palestine complete. wrapped up in a nice clean package with Zionist ribbons. Samuel, so a Jew signing a document on behalf of Britain, turning Palestine over to the Jews. No, they have no power and influence at all, folks. Isn't it what the Jews consistently claim? We don't have any power. That's a myth. Traditional British historians have tended to regard Herbert Samuel as an impartial administrator in the emerging conflict between Palestinian Arabs and Zionists. No, can't be. He's a Jew. Sahar Hunaidi, an Arab scholar living in London, challenges this claim in a major revisionist study of the early period of the Mandate. At least this author is giving both sides of the story. Okay, and this is a she. Sahar is a she. She argues that most of the measures Samuel took during his tenure in Palestine in the political, economic, and administrative spheres, were designed to prepare the ground for not just a Jewish national home, but for a fully fledged Jewish state. Using a wide range of primary sources, both English and Arabic, Hunaidi charts Samuel's career in Palestine against the complex background of British policy in the region. She argues convincingly that during Samuel's 5 years as High Commissioner in Palestine from 1920 to 1925, he remained an ardent supporter of Zionism. But under the impact of fierce anti-Jewish riots, he began to doubt the practicality of a policy which seemed, as he put it, to be a recipe for a second Ireland. Oh, yeah, and the Jews are the ones who destroyed Ireland. He therefore devised endless schemes to draw the Arab notables into the political community of Palestine. These schemes all proved inadequate, however, to the task of reconciling the Arabs of Palestine to Zionism. What would you expect? Would you expect the Palestinian Arab to simply concede to Jewish power?
I don't know what they're... yeah, it shows their power, as I say. What to expect of it.
Yeah, and there's no occupied people who would agree to any such thing. And they still haven't agreed to it.
No.
For good reason.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah.
And the Arabs in themselves, the Palestine themselves, had no say in it either. They were the one that was affected by it. So that's so insane with this.
Yeah, the first leader of the Palestinian people stupidly signed an agreement with the Zionists to his later regret because he had a sentimental idea that the Jews are the Israel of the Bible. Right? If only he had known better. Okay. Continuing. The failure of his attempts to bring Arabs and Jews together within a unified political framework led Samuel to try to satisfy each community separately. And that's basically the history of Palestine ever since. Okay. So you have pro-Palestinian and pro-Jewish forces in Palestine, in Israel, duking it out ever since. His preferred method was the devolution of power to the increasingly separate Arabic and Jewish communal institutions. This policy encouraged a trend towards the internal partition of Palestine. So this is the so-called two-state movement, that a portion of the land would go to the Palestinian Arabs and another portion would go to the Jews. Now, this also excludes the interest of Palestinian Christians, okay, because there were a lot of Palestinian Christians there whose rights were being totally ignored. Under Samuel's successors, it gathered further momentum while alleviating the intercommunal conflict in the short run. This process exacerbated the long-term problem by driving Arabs and Jews further and further apart. What do you expect? Had the two communities built, do you expect the Arabs to adopt Judaism? Do you expect the Jews to adopt Islam? All right. The two religions are antagonistic. As the two communities built up the institutional strength required for the struggle ahead, the government of Palestine became little more than an umpire. And that umpire took a few bullets to the head. Isaiah Berlin, an Anglo-Jewish supporter of Zionism and a prescient observer, was moved to compare the Palestine mainland to a minor English public school. There was the headmaster, the high commissioner, trying to be firm and impartial, but he had a switch. He had a stick to enforce his rule. But the assistant masters favored the sporting, stupid boarders, Arabs, against the clever SWAT day boys, Jews, who had the deplorable habit of writing home to their parents on the slightest provocation to complain about the quality of the teaching, the food, and so on. Okay? So, in any conflict between Jews and any other people, do the other people's voices ever get heard in the court of international justice, so-called?
Never.
Never.
They own them, so they will never be heard. You only hear their views. That's why also the media is in their hand too, because they only hear their views in the media.
That's right. That's right. Somebody did a survey of American media on the subject of Palestinians' rights, and less than 2 or 3% of articles in the so-called American media champion the rights of Palestinians. The rest is all pro-Jewish. The role of umpire became increasingly difficult to sustain with the passage of time. High commissioners came and went, but their hands were tied by the pledge of 2nd November 1917. Shortly after his arrival in Palestine, I mean, at this point, the author is being very accurate and fair. But when he started calling, you know, the British cabinet, you know, mystical, you know, and that their ideas of problems with this document you know, anti-Semitism, I mean, he was really off. Okay. Anyway, continue here. Shortly after his arrival in Palestine in December 1928, Sir John Chancellor reached the conclusion that the Balfour Declaration had been a colossal blunder, unfair to the Arabs and detrimental to the interests of the British Empire. There you go. In January 1930, he sent a long memorandum to London. He wanted to extricate Britain from the Balfour Declaration and to deal a blow to Zionism. I wonder how much longer Chancellor lived after taking this position. His ideas were given a respectful hearing in London, and the king asked for a copy. On learning that the king would like to hear from him directly about the state of affairs in Palestine, Chancellor obliged with a 16-page letter explaining why, in Chancellor's view, Britain's national home policy in Palestine was misguided, unjust, and impossible to carry out. The Jews took the view that the Arabs of Palestine were free to go to any part of Arabia. Okay. Yeah, let the inhabitants for the last 1,500 years, let them go. We're staying. And that they should be induced to move to Transjordan. So why should, you know, why should the people who've lived there for 1,500 years be expected to move just because a Jew wants their land? That's not fair. But it is Jewish. Yeah, it's easy for them to say, for the Jews to say, let the Arabs leave. Chancellor was strongly opposed to any such action on the grounds that it would be inconsistent with the part of the Balfour Declaration, which laid down in the establishment of a Jewish national home, nothing should be done to prejudice the rights of the non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Chancellor portrayed the Jews as an emotional people. How about fierce? How about resentful? How about angry and imperialistic? Quote, what makes them difficult to deal with is that they are, regardless of the rights and feelings of others, very exacting in pressing their own claims. Even as a minority of the population of Palestine, the Jews adopt towards the Arabs an attitude of arrogant superiority, chutzpah, which is hotly resented by the Arabs with their traditions of courtesy and good manners. Wow. Talk about an honest assessment. Now, Michael, I have to say, this is the first I've heard of Mr. Chancellor. I may have heard his name bandied about on this subject of Palestine, but I've never heard his views expressed like this. Let me read this again, folks, because this really sums it up well. What makes the Jews difficult to deal with is that they are, regardless of the rights and feelings of others, including us, very exacting in pressing their own claims. Even as a minority of the population of Palestine, the Jews, and what country aren't the Jews a minority in except Israel? Very exacting in pressing their own claims. Even as a minority of the population of Palestine, the Jews adopt towards the Arabs an attitude of arrogant superiority, which is hotly resented by the Arabs with their traditions of courtesy and good manners. End of quote. Nor did the Jews cherish genuine sentiments of loyalty towards Britain. In spite of what they said on public occasions when it was in their interest to proclaim their devotion, quote, the bulk of the Jewish population of Palestine have little feeling of gratitude or loyalty towards Great Britain, for what she has done for the establishment of the Jewish national home, unquote. Having delivered this tirade against the Jews, Chancellor returned to the basic problem facing Britain and made a concrete proposal for dealing with it. I'm interested in finding out what happened to him, how much longer he lived after this. The facts of the situation are that in the dire straits of the war, the British government made promises to the Arabs and promises to the Jews, which are inconsistent with one another and are incapable of fulfillment. The honest course is to admit our difficulty and to say to the Jews that, in accordance with the Balfour Declaration, we have favored the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine, and that a Jewish national home in Palestine has in fact been established and will be maintained, and that without violating the other part of the Balfour Declaration, without prejudicing the interests of the Arabs, we cannot do more than we have done. In other words, Chancellor is saying we need to wash our hands of the situation. Isn't that what Pontius Pilate did when he washed his hands of the Jewish declaration to murder Jesus Christ?
Yeah, it shows exactly again how they press for their opinion again. Exactly as, mm-hmm. as you see here. I mean, they will. Let's see what happened to this chancellor. Will he just stop it, or will he end up in some kind of accident or something like that?
Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, Jewish lightning has happened before.
Okay. All right, with about 10 minutes left, why don't you take the next couple of paragraphs here?
Of course. Chancellor's memorandum, along with number of other reports that also underlined the gravity of the situation in Palestine, contributed to a reformulation of the official line in London. In October 1930, after several discussions in cabinet, Colonial Secretary Lord Pasifield issued a white paper, the premises and principle and innovation of which was that the Balfour Declaration imposed on Britain a binary and equal obligation toward both Jews and Arabs. Accordingly, Jewish immigrants to Palestine was linked to the Arab as well as the Jewish economy in the past. Jewish immigration, quotes, were determined by the absorptive capacity of the Palestinian economy. From this point on, Jews were to be allowed into the country only at a rate that would not put Arabs out of jobs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, out of jobs.
And sounds fair to me.
No, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, well, they can't occupy those jobs if they're murdered. Right? Okay. Yeah, that's how the Jews think.
In the spirit of a councilor proposal, the white paper assumed that the Jews would remain a minority. Chancellor and his officials were pleased by his redefinition of official policy, but their success was short-lived. Dr. Wiseman succeeded in getting the new policy reversed within a few months. Once again, the Zionists had won, and the Arabs failed in London.
Well, there you go. No, the Jews have no power whatsoever. They're so persecuted, folks. They're the most persecuted people on the planet.
No, they persecute us. They persecute That's everybody right. else.
Mm-hmm. The value of this article is it's bringing to the forefront history that I never heard of before. And I've done a lot of study on the Balfour Declaration. So I've never heard of Lord Pasfield. I've never heard of Chancellor. And I've never heard of this white paper, which was an attempt to ease the conflict between Jews and Palestinians. Obviously didn't work. Back to you.
Thank you. So, as Chancellor had predicted, unrestricted Jewish immigration and land purchases in Palestine produced further unrest and periodic outbreaks of violence. the fundamental contradiction between Arab nationalist aspiration and Britain's in 1917 undertaking. Two, the Jews continued to render the mandate inoperable. The influx of German Jews to Palestine following the Nazi rise to power in 1933 proved a deep anxiety among the Arabs. In 1936, the Arab High Committee declared a general strike with the aim of halting Jewish immigration, banning the sale of land to Jews, and establishing an independent national government. The general strike snowballed into a full-scale revolt that was to last 3 years. The British government's belated response to the outbreak of the Arab rebellion consisted of appointing a royal commission with Earl Peel as chairman to investigate the underlying causes of the disturbance. The Peel Commission's report went to the heart of the problem. Under the stress of the World War, the British government made promises to Arabs and Jews in order to obtain their support. On the strength of those promises, both parties formed certain expectations. An irrepressible conflict has arisen between two national communities within the narrow bounds of a small country. There is no common ground between them. This conflict was inherent in the situation from the outset. We cannot, in Palestine as it is now, both concede the Arabs' claim of self-government and secure the establishment of the Jewish national home. This conflict between the two obligations is all the more unfortunate because each of them, taken separately, accords with British sentiment and British interest.
Okay. The song by the Loving Spoonful, you have to make up your mind. Choose one and leave the other behind, okay? You cannot, it's like Judeo-Christianity. You can't support Judaism and Christianity at the same time because they are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
The only possible solution is to let them each have their own country. But since that territory does not belong to the Jews in any way, shape, or form, the full justice thing would be to expel the Jews and send them to Madagascar, right, where they belong, where Hitler wanted to send them in the first place. Back to you, Michael.
Yeah, the problem with the Jews, they can't have their own nation because they're parasites. They cannot be for themselves.
Right.
They would kill themselves. They need to have a host to get their blood or their money.
And that's what's happening in Judea land right now, is they're fighting amongst themselves so viciously that there's a threat of civil war. Okay. And but we have there's a lot of anti-Zionists even today in Jew land. Okay. And so they're still duking it out. I mean, they have these I forget what these rabbis call themselves. One group is called Netzarai Carter. They're actually based in New York City, that says the only way the Jews could take over Palestine is when the Messiah comes, their Messiah, right? And so they hold strictly to that viewpoint, but the Zionists totally ignore their position, right? But there are such people who within the political scenario of Jewland that a lot of them hate Bibi Netanyahu because, look, you're looking at a totally corrupt state. And so the one group that is being supported mostly by all this corruption is hated by the group that's not being supported by the corruption, and they want their share of the corruption, right? And that's what the Jews fight about over themselves, right? Back to you, Michael.
Thank you. The Peel Commission proposed the partition of Palestine. The logic behind partition was unassessable. It was the only solution then, and it remains the only solution today, to the tragic conflict between the two national movements. Yeah, and you cannot parse in between, because the Jews want everything. If you give them this, right, they will take your whole arm after some time.
That's right, exactly.
In 1937, the Jews accepted partition, but the Arabs rejected it. So the conflict continued and the violence escalated. The Arab rebellion of 1936-9 demonstrated once again that there could be no compromise between the two rival communities in Palestine. Only war could decide the issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Jewish community was militarily weak and vulnerable. It would have been easily defeated had Britain not intervened to restore law and order.
Oh, yeah. What law? What order?
No, it was by the order from the Jewish bankers in London to intervene.
That's right.
The Jewish national home, in the last resort, had to be defended by British bayonets.
Just as the integration of American schools had to be enforced by federal bayonets against the segregated schools of the South.
Okay. Yeah, not many know that.
It's not in the history books, okay? Neither is any of this that we're talking about. This is not in the history books. Okay. All right, Michael, good job. I think next week, because we've assessed the situation as well as possible, that this is a really valuable article. It presents both points of view, and it contains information that is not